So this is the 30th of March, 2019. 31st of March, 2019. I'm just saying that for there's a recorder on first day of the April Fool's retreat. With all the appropriate people gathered. So this is Dharma talk practice. It just means I talk with my whole self. You listen with your whole self. It doesn't really matter what I say. It doesn't really matter what you hear. But the fact that we're doing this together is the kind of central point of it. This together action. Talking and listening, host and guest. It is more what it's really about than anything I say. It's not about whether you agree or disagree with what I say. Doesn't matter if I know what I'm saying. But here we are. So we don't pay attention to the words in the sense of separating ourselves, agreeing, disagreeing, liking, preferring, comparing. Just the act of being together in this is the intimacy of the Dharma, the teaching, the practice. But not in a solemn way, please. Alan Watts famously in an interview I heard, must have been in the mid-1970s, of the BBC. He kept on making these sort of outrageous statements in these kind of prophetic clothes and so on. He cut an impressive figure. And the BBC interviewer just kept on saying, but you can't be serious. Mr. Watts, you can't be serious. And he said, oh, I'm always serious. I'm just never solemn. Anyway. So, we're going to look at a koan this morning from a book called The Blue Cliff Record. Some of you are familiar with it, some of you aren't. It's a collection of what we call koan. It's a koan stories. And talks about the teaching. They sit in China, and they usually involve kind of a lineage of Zen teachers and Zen monks who practiced during the Tang Dynasty in China, which is about 600 to 900 AD. CE, they call it now. And sort of legendary figures of the tradition. and the book was compiled at about 1000 to 1100 AD CE, again in China. And no one really cares whether the stories they're talking about are true or not. It's not the point somehow. But they've become part of the teaching tradition, just like some other religious traditions have a strong kind of story base. In fact, the first copy of the Blue Cliff record, when it was compiled, was considered to be so dangerous to sincere practice and so inclined to make people think too much that the first copies were burnt. Can't remember who it was, another legendary Zen master of the time burnt all the copies, and the copy that remains was discovered centuries later in a monastery somewhere in central China. It's always been a kind of much discussed document, but it's the closest that we get in the Zen tradition to a kind of a formal body of teaching, and I say mostly in stories, and has its very own particular style, which you'll see if you try to read it as leisure reading. It'll just infuriate you, and understandably, yeah. Okay. So this is case 88. Xuan Sha's guiding and aiding all living beings. And they usually start with a pointer, which is quite poetic and bright. Taking charge of the situation, he hits home and smashes to pieces the golden chains and the hidden barrier. He acts according to the imperative, obliterating all tracks and traces. Tell me, where is there any confusion? For those who have the eye on their forehead, I bring this case up for you to see. Gives you an idea of the style. Which will make you shake your head. Golden chains are sort of monastic rules and teachings. The Zen tradition has always considered the teachings to be chains of gold. And you need to break the chains of gold to really understand their true value. That style. Xuan Sha, teaching the community, said, "The old adepts everywhere all speak of guiding and aiding living beings. Supposing they encountered three kinds of sick person, how would they guide them? With a blind person, they could pick up the gavel or raise the whisk, but he wouldn't see. With a deaf person, he wouldn't hear the point of words. With a mute person, if they had him speak, he wouldn't be able to speak. But how would they guide such people? And if they couldn't guide these people, then the Buddha Dharma has no effect." That's the start of the story. So Xuan Sha, legendary Zen teacher, has a very strong sense of where the Dharma is, what we call the Dharma, the teachings, the practice, what we do, our life. So each evening we chant, we say, wherever there's suffering, we'll open our hearts. Traditionally the words are, however many beings there are, we vow to save them all. save them from suffering. And then the question arises always, but how do I embody that? And it might be easy with people that we normally mix with to know they will hear your words, they'll be able to see what you're doing. And that isn't always the case, obviously. So how do you transmit the Dharma? How do you guide and aid the person in front of you if they are not able to relate to you in some way? How do you transmit the Dharma to a drunk person? A wonderful question. Yeah. You shouldn't be drunk. Okay, good luck. How do you... I was a monk for a few years in a very traditional Zen monastery, and one of the Zen masters' favorite koans he would ask us is, how do you become one with a drunk man? Show me. Become one with drunk man. That's what this koan's about. We know by now, all of us, we can't choose the person in front of us or next to us, around us. How do we embody this teaching in a situation like that? It's the statement of Xuan Sha is that if we can't do that, then this Dharma, this teaching, is useless. If we can only communicate it amongst people that we feel understand us, that like us, that appreciate us, where we can sit around a dinner table and drink herbal tea and talk of fresh food, what is it? And health foods and homeopathic remedies. Then I suspect we're barking up a very closed alley. And particularly in this country, part of the vibrancy and, of course, terror of living here is that we are all the time slightly at sea, in slightly unfamiliar terrain. How do we apply the Dharma there? How do we find its real kind of depth and vibrancy and aliveness? How do you relate in that? How do you relate to someone who's just stolen your laptop? How do you relate to someone who's got you by the throat? If we step back from that situation, we kind of work in even more stereotypes. St. Francis said, be nice to everybody, so you've got me by the neck. I say, I understand you have a hard life. We sort of romanticize what we should be doing, but we're not really inside that moment. Bomb. I remember being at the London Underground. It must have been winter, early 70s, trying to stay warm. So I used to travel all over the place and spend the whole day in the trains and then buy a cheap ticket, and I would then leave where I, more or less where I started. And there was a man trying to steal from a woman's bag who was walking, and I warned her, and this guy turned around and he took me by the throat and said, like, your thing, and he just sort of ran with me against one of the walls of the platform. So we just went boom against the back wall and my throat. So what do you do then? Okay. It's not a moment where you think, what should I do? I think that's the most important thing. You don't think, I should be good to him now. Or I should, whatever it is, I'm trying to be a nice person, or, you know, trying not to get a criminal record, all of that sort of thing. There's no strategic thinking. There's something that arises from the depth of that moment, of that encounter, that is a real response. And we can't think strategically then, because that's a kind of separation. How should I do it? That's what they call confusion. So the way we look at it here, the way the practice teaches us, as I see it, anyway, is that we sink into our practice. And then we embody it. We put it into action. And in doing that, we relate to what is, to what's in front of us. Regardless of what we think about it, it's there anyway. So this morning we had this wonderfully interesting situation with someone who's been learning how to help prepare breakfast, just not appearing. And Margie, of course, bears the brunt of that, so that was her moment of practice, you know. And she didn't try and say the politically correct thing. She just said, "I can't believe this cuck." It's very clear. Okay. And the moment we start sort of standing back and saying, "Oh, that's not really so nice. You know, she looks like such a benign old lady." And look at the truth. Whatever it is. That happens. How do you relate to the person who's in charge of the kitchen when something like that happens? "Can I help wash up?" Very clear. But if you say, "Oh, I should have gone to help wash up," you're already back in confusion again. Okay? That's wonderful. It's wonderful. So if your response is just to get the water ready for the morning talk, go and do your morning ablutions, that's also very clear, very clear. So at all points, the sense of not standing back and judging ourselves or other people, that's absolutely crucial. That's the kind of hook that we have. Koans work through kind of hooks. They kind of tempt you, see if you bite. And we do, endlessly. However long we do this. And the hook in all of, or every situation is, am I going to separate and judge myself? I mean, I should have done this, or that's not correct, or whatever it is. Already we've complicated our moment. It's much more a question of spontaneous action that's coming out of our practice as best we can. Of course, there's, quote, spontaneous action that comes out of my self-concern. There's that kind of action as well. And if I just feel a victim because something's happened, everything is pointing to me. There's that kind of quality about it. I think what the practice does is just gives us an opportunity to allow the action that we do to come from a point of going beyond our self-concern. But I think let's leave that for now. If we think too much about that, that's just another hole we're falling into. Our only work is to take this practice, take this teaching, and just let it stain us through and through and through. And to do our best to act from there. And then if we make what we later think is a mistake, then that mistake is part of the way. Part of this great way. Then we have a chance, because we're not worried about whether it's correct or incorrect all the time. We're not worried about what other people think. We're not being strategic about everything. Then we have a chance to act fearlessly, humorously, creatively. All because it comes from a base of that is not ridden with self-concern. And of course it's an endless practice. So when put it differently, how do we communicate the Dharma, meaning how do we live out this teaching with a rich person, with a poor person, with an assailant, with a spouse, with Mr. Trump, with Mr. Zuma, the Dalai Lama, Mr. Mandela, someone who likes us, someone who doesn't. In each moment we're confronted with what is the person in front of us. How can we relate to them from inside of that relationship? Far beyond right and wrong and correct and incorrect. So we have a question this morning. There won't be interviews this morning. We have someone who has a birthday today. How do we present the Dharma to someone who has a birthday? Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Teresa. Happy birthday to you. That's right. And she says, thank you very much. That's a very clear action. That's our practice. Okay. Thank you very much.